Today's program has been brought to you by Kane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit Kane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, live from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to the Farm Report. I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks, and today we are going to be taking a trip kind of around the world. We're going to be looking at Northeast India, a place in the world that produces some of our finest teas, and we're going to be exploring the lives of the folks producing those teas. We're going to be joined by two guests today. And to start us off, we have Sarah Besky. Sarah is an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology and the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you recently published a book, The Darjeeling Distinction, Labor and Justice on Fair Trade Tea Plantations in India. And I'm curious, how did you start, where did kind of your interest in tea and tea plantations come from?
Well, honestly, I drank tea, and I wanted to know more about it. I had worked in Nepal on various kind of projects in college and after college and before grad school. And when I went to grad school in anthropology, I was just kind of looking for a project that asked questions about labor and environment, but also kind of got at a global circulation and social justice. And so that just kind of brought me to tea, because like, my own kind of practices were implicated in tea production, being a tea drinker.
Yeah. So I know that we are going to be asking you to cover some really complicated and broad topics in a very short period of time. So I want to apologize in advance. But I'm hoping what we can do today is kind of, set a little bit of an outline for folks to start to understand what the life of a typical tea worker looks like in the regions that you studied. And maybe you can give us a sense of what are some of the jobs or tasks, and who are the kind of people that make up those folks who are growing the tea?
Sure. So, I'm going to talk all about plantations in particular, and so that's where my work was. So a plantation in Darjeeling, India, it comprises both permanent and temporary laborers, and about 60% of the workforce, 60 to 70% of the workforce is women. And so anything that kind of constitutes hand labor, so plucking as well as sorting and pruning tea, is all done by women. Generally things that are done with machines, so that's the kind of firing and drying and withering of tea in the factory, as well as the spraying and other kind of more higher level mechanical work is done by men. So there's a pretty distinct gender division of labor on plantations. And so the working day is, from 7 to 4 in the morning with an hour-long break in the middle of the day, and 9 months out of the year, women pluck tea. So it's unlike coffee or wine, right, which are these annual harvests. Tea is something that you pluck every day, and depending on the day and the season and even the plantation, right, those all constitute kind of different vintages. So the ecology of tea is very different than for those of you who are familiar with coffee, the coffee berries get red and then you pluck them. It's something that requires constant attention, and so that's why there's a large permanent labor force on plantations.
And now I want to talk a little bit about this term plantation. What does that mean, and where does that kind of setup come from?
Sure. So we all probably have some sort of an idea of what a plantation is, generally probably rooted in our own, histories and experiences with, the U.S. South or cotton production. And there are generally variations on a theme. Plantations imply that workers live and work on a plot of land that they do not own. In the case of Indian tea plantations, plantations are actually leased from the state government by owners. And those owners, give workers a daily wage, which is actually kept artificially low because workers or owners are also supposed to and obligated by labor law to provide facilities or what they call social costs, which include food rations and housing and road repair and nurseries and milk in those nurseries and various other kind of I guess you could call welfare structures on the plantation. So workers are, in a similar sense, bonded to the plantation by the fact that they don't actually receive enough cash to, it's kind of just a subsistence level amount of cash, but kind of general day-to-day necessities are provided for, like housing, like basic food rations, which include rice and flour.
So I know that, there is a caste system within India, and I'm wondering, you kind of touched on the challenges with regards to, deciding like, hey, I'm done, working on the tea plantation, I want to leave, and some of the barriers there. But can you give us a sense of like within the kind of agriculture community within India, like where do tea workers kind of sit on that kind of prestige hierarchy? And are you kind of born into picking tea? I mean, what's the kind of labor flow look like?
So tea is not a caste occupation in any respect. Caste is not necessarily something that matters in the sense it may matter in other locations. Generally, but you are in a way kind of born into tea because jobs are not, there's not a free market for labor. So if you're my mother and you retire from plucking tea, you can pass that job to me as your daughter. That's how jobs are generally transferred. There's a kind of a finite number of jobs on a given plantation, and they're transferred through kin lines. So it's not like a caste occupation and you're born into it in that respect. It is something that, a job exists and it can be transferred between family members.
And as far as like deciding that, you don't want to work on it, like, I'm just wondering if I'm growing up on a plantation, what are my options look like as a young girl or a teenager? Are folks mostly staying within that system or is there some flight there?
Well, because there's only one job, say again, you're my mother and you have four children, only one of them gets that plantation job. So your other three children, their options are quite limited. Education in Darjeeling, though, it was kind of this bastion of colonial education. It's generally fairly good, but it's expensive, and work only a very few number of workers' children go on to college and are able to kind of have the capital to access those realms. And there's no jobs in Darjeeling outside of tea and tourism, really. There's three industries: tea, timber, and tourism. Timber is a state-run venture, and is just kind of it's just a different thing, and I'll. So you have really kind of two options. It's tea or it's tourism, and otherwise you have to leave. And there's a great number of amount of literature on this, and many people have talked about it. There's kind of ethnically appropriate labor that was categorized by the British. The British kind of laid over the landscape of people that they conquered. That certain people were good at certain kinds of jobs. And so Nepalese, right, which is kind of the labor force of Darjeeling plantations, were kind of ethnicized as good at driving, good at service labor, like working as nannies or as domestic servants. So we kind of see these colonial legacies today remade So workers, children go on to be domestic servants in Singapore or drivers in Delhi. Those are kind of the options that workers have. There's no jobs in Darjeeling.
So I want to move into the kind of fair trade conversation because that was a big focus of your work. And, I feel like in the reading that I've done, fair trade is not kind of delivering for these workers on the promises that I, as maybe a consumer drinking tea with my breakfast, think it is. And I'm wondering if you can start to unpack that a little bit for us.
Right. And so I think on those fair trade packages that we buy, kind of the number one thing that's told to us is that people who are participating in the fair trade system or producers that are participating in the fair trade system get a better yield, a monetary yield for the whatever they're growing, whatever it may be. And that's just not the case for plantation workers, because those wages that I kind of discussed before are set by state mandated wage agreements. So every plantation worker, no matter if it's a fair trade, an organic plantation, or whatever kind of certification it might have, each worker makes the same exact wage. A fair trade plantation cannot guarantee workers any higher wage. So it's kind of that distillation of, as consumers, what we think fair trade is, that fair trade really can't physically, it's impossible to kind of yield higher wages on plantations.
So, is the majority of, if I'm drinking Darjeeling, does it only come from plantations? I mean, how do we get a sense of, like, making better choices as consumers with regards to our tea consumption that's, reflecting kind of our values with regards to how food is being produced?
Right. So, I mean, most tea that is produced in the post-colonial world is produced on plantations. And even the very marginal small farmers that they are, they have to sell their tea often to what are called bought leaf tea factories in India, or to just other plantations. So even small farmers rely on the plantation system. It's this behemoth within kind of the tea production in the post-colonial world. It's hard to kind of escape. So it's hard to kind of buy to try to use your consumption to buy something that's not produced on a plantation, because even these small farms are implicated in the production of the plantation production system.
You're not painting a very optimistic picture for me. What do you do as a tea drinker to feel okay about the tea you're consuming?
I'm honest about the fact that it is an oppressive system, and I try to drink and to consume less, and maybe not to consume or to feel that, by consuming more that I'm doing something necessarily good. And I know that's not necessarily optimistic, but I think the thing that's most problematic with fair trade is that it makes us feel that we can, kind of overcome or undo the historical legacies of consumption that exacerbated or produced, marginalization in the third world in the first place. That made tea plantations an answer to a question of supply and demand. And fair trade, nothing can undo that. So, be with that problem, to be with that trouble. Is something that we should do when we consume these colonial products. And it's important to kind of note that what products fair trade works with. They're all colonial kind of products. They're all plantation-based products. Certainly, there's small farmers that produce them as well. But, it's coffee, it's tea, it's bananas, it's sugar. I mean, these crops are implicated in the dispossession of umpteen number of people, and the transformation of landscapes across the world. So that's what I kind of think about when I drink tea, and I do drink tea. And I bring back tea every year from when I go to Darjeeling. But that's kind of what I think about. I don't think about how my consumption practices necessarily make things better, unfortunately.
And I'm curious, when you're looking to other kind of major tea producing areas of the world, China, Japan, how does India sit in that context? Do we have any sense of the impact of our tea drinking choices when we look from continent to continent?
My work I focus on the post-colonial world. China and Japan are very different stories. They have very different histories. And as an anthropologist, right, I always kind of want us to think about the fact that, everywhere is not the same, right? And that universalized kind of systems can't be applied without kind of massive transformations or kind of thinking about the local kind of dynamics, particularly state-based governmental dynamics that exist. So it's different. India is different than Sri Lanka. India is different than Kenya. India is different than, you know, Japan and China, for lots and lots of reasons. But I mean, the major difference being between China and Japan, say, for example, is kind of a history of tea growing and the plantation system.
Yeah, and I thought that was so the kind of resistance of being able to put thing in kind of like one, you know, one bucket that's kind of like easy to understand, I think is essentially what feels like to me the kind of point of your work, is like looking at this, you know, these things. If we're thinking about these big issues, these big ideas of fairness and value and justice, that we can't essentially separate them out from the kind of historical context.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Tea is not the same everywhere. Coffee is not the same everywhere. Take a crop, it's not the same everywhere, because, it is made different by the context it is in. And similarly, justice, for example, doesn't mean the same everywhere.
Excellent. Well, Sarah, what is the best way for folks to purchase your book?
It's available on Amazon or the University of California Press has a beautiful website, and it is available at ucpress.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today to kind of give us some broad strokes as we start to think about agriculture production in different parts of the world. It's been really great having you.
Great. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking.
So stay tuned. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will be on the line with Peter Rosenblum, who is a professor of international law and human rights at Bard College, and we're going to continue our discussion on tea and tea production in Northeast India. So hang tight. You're listening to the Farm Report, and we'll be right back.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
All right, we are back. You're tuned into the Farm Report. And in this half of the show, we are joined on the line by Peter Rosenblum. Peter is a professor of international law and human rights at Bard College, and most recently is co-author of a report, The More Things Change, The World Bank, Tata, and Enduring Abuses on India's Tea Plantations. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So I'm curious, how did you get engaged in the world of tea?
Well, my partner, Ashwini Sukhtankar, had been involved in labor rights and transnational labor rights issues for a long time, and I've been involved in other kinds of human rights issues. And we were in India when the Fair Trade Labeling Organization was looking to investigate the its own hired labor standards in the tea sector. And at that point, Ashwini took on the work, and I came along as an unpaid consultant, and that opened up to us to the world of tea plantations and certifications and labor conditions on the plantations.
Yeah, so in the executive summary of your report, you know, I was reading that tea plantations in India employ more than 1 million permanent workers and perhaps twice as many seasonal laborers, making it the largest private sector employer in the country. And, you know, we were talking in the first part of the show with Sarah Besky out at the University of Michigan, whose work focuses primarily on the Darjeeling region. And this report was focused more on Assam. Is that correct?
That's right. And we had met Sarah Besky when we started our fair trade work, and we're really blown away by the quality of her work. And then as we moved on, we stayed in touch. But it's true that this project involves what we think of more as industrial tea production in Assam. Assam is everything that says English breakfast tea is Assam tea. And, you know, one thing that I didn't realize until I started working in the tea world is there's only two bushes. There's Assam bush and China bush. And the rest is soil and conditions. So Assam is a very particular place in the tea world. Huge story in terms of the history of tea and colonialism and in terms of the numbers of people employed in the sector as well.
Well, so I want to get a little bit of the lay of the land you know, over the course of the last century. And I'm hoping you can talk us through a little bit the 1951 Plantations Labor Act, you know, what that is and why it came about.
So the story of plantations was a story where largely the British government encouraged British planters to come in and take over large swaths of land, which remained owned by the state but controlled by the planters. And the planters really ran what is one step removed from the world of slavery. Indentured servitude, labor restrictions. They brought in tribal workers from a neighboring province, and they controlled their lives. And the better side of that can be called paternalism. They give them food, they give them housing, they give them education and health care. And the worst side is really the bonded labor or indentured servitude. And the purpose of what the law did when India became independent and soon afterwards was, rather than breaking up the plantations and bringing the state in and giving land to the workers, the state basically tried to raise the level of paternalism to a reasonable level. So to try to make the paternalism into a requirement that, in fact, the planter has to provide education, has to provide health care, has to provide rations and other elements of life. And in many ways, you know, that's why the law embodies a kind of ambivalence. On the one hand, these are important rights and needs that should be met by the planters. On the other hand, even if they were met, what you would have is kind of the perfection of a very paternalist system that still maintains the plantation structure.
So kind of fast forwarding to more recent history and the focus of your report, you were looking at the Amalgamated Plantations Private, LTD. So can you give us a sense of what the kind of stated goal of that project was?
Well, so what's happened in the tea sector, in this industrial sector, is something that we saw in globalization and other fields before, including apparel and electronics. Companies find out that the real money is made in being a brand and in marketing, and that having workers and employees is risky business and you can lose a lot on it, and they'd rather just get out of that business and be free of them. And so one of the world's largest tea companies, Unilever, the world's largest, just got out of the plantation business from one day to the next. The second largest is Tata, which is a company that we tend not to know that well in the West, although if you tell people that Tata owns Jaguar and Land Rover and 8 o'clock coffee, people realize it's already in your lives. It's a Indian-based company, but it owns a lot of Western brands. And it was Tata that decided to sell its plantations But in order to do it, it did it in this very creative way where it brought the World Bank in and set up this company that you referred to, this APPL, Amalgamated Plantations. And so it turned this investment into a kind of development project with World Bank investment and the promise to live up to standards even higher than the Plantation Labor Act standards.
So, you know, it seems like the passage of the Plantations Labor Act and the APPL kind of both sold to, I don't know, the public or to consumers as projects that had the interest, maybe not the best interest, but the interest of the plantation workers in mind. But I feel like you found the reality of that was not the case on the ground. And maybe you can give us some examples of, you know, what we're hearing and then maybe what you were kind of actually seeing.
Yeah, I think the tragedy that we're in right now is that companies now realize that they have to say that they are socially responsible and they can be certified by Rainforest Alliance, by Fair Trade, by SA 8000, which is another of these certification bodies. The World Bank has its own set of standards, and they can say it, but actually they realize that they've gotten away for so long without doing anything that they haven't done anything now either. So what happened was Tata and APPL and the World Bank said they were living up to all these higher standards. And the fact of the matter is they're not even living up to the standards of the PLA of 1950. And what this means is that you walk onto the plantations, you walk into the labor living quarters where people live, and houses are crumbling, the latrines are just repulsive, and just nothing new has even been built there in years except with UNICEF support, and they're inferior. The water systems are terrible. Waterborne diseases are a problem. The doctors are nasty and brutal with the workers. And workers, if even to get sick leave, they have to show up three times a day at the hospital so that if they were sick, they would never be able to do it in order to get sick leave. And then there's other things like the fact that since 1960, the law has been gender neutral, but they still enforce it in a way that is privileging only men and their wives as opposed to the husbands of female workers. So there's a lot of obvious violations, and they're really obvious. It's not a mystery. It's just the fact that they've gotten away with it for so long that people treat this as isolated, hard to get to, no one knows what happens there, and so it kind of drifted off the screens of world opinion and world awareness. If 20 years ago, if you said to the companies, you're not living up to the standards of the Plantation Labor Act, they would have said, yeah, we know that, because nobody denied it 20 years ago. Now they're not only denying it, but they're claiming they're living up to even higher standards.
So, I mean, as a tea drinker, this leaves me feeling like a little bit at a loss. You know, if I'm trying to, you know, make responsible decisions, and, you know, you're kind of throwing out all the labels that I kind of look to for guidance and telling me that I can't do that anymore. So, you know, what can we do? What should we be doing? You know, how do we, you know, as folks who aren't going to focus our life on, you know, working to change the lives of these plantation workers, but have an investment in, you know, making sure that our purchasing dollars are reflecting our values as consumers. What's our role here?
You know, I don't want to, like, to despair. I believe that these systems, these certification mechanisms, they give us levers, but they don't work by themselves. And so we have to use those levers. The good news after when we first did our report, the company denounced us and claimed we were defaming them. But over the next weeks, the company mobilized resources. They've actually been using money to improve housing. They've done their own social audit. They're doing other things so that they recognize that if the pressure is on them, that they're going to have to live up to these standards. So I don't want to give up on Fair Trade or on SA 8000, but I want to bother those guys. I want to tell them that they are not living up to what they claimed. I think Fair Trade is in real trouble because maybe you heard this from Sarah Besky, but I think they got involved without at all understanding the complexity of plantation structures. And so I think fair trade tea is from India is not better than other teas from India. There's no reason to think you're getting anything better by buying fair trade. I think that you've got to use the labels, but be active consumers. Write letters, write emails. Social accountability, SA 8000 responds. Fair trade will hear it. Organizations like Equal Exchange and others that are part of the fair trade movement have recognized that the fair trade labeling organizations are in trouble. And so there are places to go to support to agitate. I don't want to give up these labeling mechanisms and the certifications, but I know that they don't work by themselves.
So kind of the checks and balances, you know, we as consumers are providing those checks by essentially, it sounds a little bit like, I don't know, poking the bear, but like just kind of like, hey, we're watching, we're asking, we're paying attention.
And frankly, that's a lot of it. The thing that makes me happiest about my report, the report that Ashwini and I did, is that at this moment there are a large number of Indian NGOs and journalists who are starting to go to these plantations and report on them. And people who are local workers' organizations that recognize that now people care again, and they're going and they're interviewing people. And that could just break the logjam and reopen an awareness.
And can you talk a little bit about kind of the, you know, reports like this, you know, this piece of work that you were able to do, how is that kind of, how is that funded? How is that made possible? Because I also want to think, like, in this discourse, you know, there's like us on the consumer level kind of, you know, poking the bear and staying in touch with regards to accountability. But oftentimes we are dependent on folks in positions like yours who are going to be doing this in-depth research. And who are the folks that, you know, you need support from in order to pursue this type of investigative work?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, at the end of the day, we did this research entirely on university research funding. I was based at Columbia Law School first and now at Bard College, and I decided that the way to do this was just to use research money and no other funds. The NGOs that are now working in the tea area in the country get scraps of funding from groups like ActionAid, which is a UK-based charity. Some of them may get money through Ford Foundation or others. There's a group called Accountability Council that's doing great work, and a group called Nazdik, and they're both really pursuing these issues with the tea worker organizations in Assam. But the funding is very limited, and the organizations that we used to rely on more, like Oxfam, some of the Dutch funders that were very active in supporting this kind of work are by and large pulling out of it. They don't do the research in India as much anymore because they consider it to be moving towards being a mid-level country. So it's a little shaky. But I must say still that the journalists are there, and as soon as there's some interest, there was a New York Times piece done on this, and the journalists went there, and others were there. And when we held a press conference in Delhi, we had a packed room, even though elections were going on. So it's hard to find the support, but it's still worthwhile and still happening.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I find so interesting is, you know, as eaters, you know, we're sitting down to breakfast, lunch, dinner, kind of taking that pause to look at the items on our plate and in our glasses. And, you know, our responsibility is essentially to kind of know what we're consuming and what the impacts of that are along the chain. And so, you know, we can push that button too, and kind of understanding the landscape and what to support and what to be thinking about, and the responsibility and where those things lie. You know, it's a lot, but I don't know. I for one find it you know, exciting and engaging and part of what makes being an eater in, you know, 2014 so great.
And I do believe that everybody's, you know, it may seem trivial, but it's about responding on websites. It's about writing emails. These certifying organizations are very sensitive. And when these companies start to hear and feel the pressure, and they know their organizations are serious, it affects them too. So it's a lever that I think that the every consumer can activate to some degree.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking some time to share a little bit of your research and knowledge.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
For folks who want to find the report, it's called The More Things Change, The World Bank, Tata, and Enduring Abuses on India's Tea Plantations. Just pop it into Google. It'll come up for free. You can read it and find out more about Peter's work and the work of others like him. Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of The Farm Report. Today's episode was co-produced by Rodney North of Equal Exchange. I want to send a big thanks for putting me in touch with both Sarah and Peter. We hope you will continue to listen. We have 35 weekly shows covering the world of food and drink. They're all available for free on our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. You can also find us on Stitcher Smart Radio. Make sure to check out their new Listen Later feature or visit us on iTunes. No matter how you find us, definitely stay tuned in. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.